Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
A serious food pair, definitely sushi. Any type of light meat or fish or cream sauce. Anything that you would pair like a nice white wine with, a nice crisp white. I'd try some bubbles.
Champagne for dinner. That's what Brad Dunn is suggesting. We know you have an extra bottle laying around from New Year's, so our resident sommelier encourages you to pop it open for dinner one night. U.S. cattle numbers may be on the rise. Harvest Public Media speculates what that could mean for consumers. We're continuing our conversation from last week about composting with a visit to Bread and Roses Gardens. The one place on the farm not covered in snow is the compost heap. And a green juice for all you folks with Eat Healthy New Year's resolutions. Here's the latest food news with Lou Ann Johnson.
Indiana legislators tried to pass three ag gag bills in 2013 and failed on every attempt. In fact, 15 such bills were introduced in 11 states last year, and not a single one became law. But Hoosier lawmakers seem to be following that old mantra, if at first you don't succeed, try again. For the second session in a row, the Indiana General Assembly will discuss legislation that would make gathering media at area farms illegal in certain situations. The proposed ag gag legislation would criminalize photographing or videotaping agricultural operations if the business is harmed. Proponents call it a measure designed to protect the property rights of Indiana farmers. Opponents call it an effort to keep the public in the dark about what happens on Indiana farms. A Senate committee is expected to vote on the bill next week. Remember the horse meat scandal of early 2013? Now it's the fox's turn. Walmart stores in China have apologized for selling tainted, five-spice donkey meat after DNA tests concluded the product also contained fox meat. Donkey is a major part of Chinese cuisine in some regions. Walmart China CEO Greg Foran apologized and said the company would investigate its Chinese supplier, according to posts on China's Weibo social media. The company has recalled the hybrid meat and is offering to reimburse customers who have already purchased it. This isn't Walmart's first black eye in the Chinese market. The world's largest retailer has been fined for manipulating prices and selling expired meat in the past. And the polar vortex was the biggest newsmaker of all this week. Nationwide, cattle prices hit record highs, in part because of the extra feed and fuel needed to keep animals fat and toasty. But Florida oranges seemed to dodge a bullet as temperatures fell just short of damaging levels, and blankets of snow protected much of the winter wheat crop. Organic producers said prevention and adaptability are key tools for weathering severe cold snaps and may put them ahead of conventional growers. Hubert Kerriman, veterinarian for the Rodale Institute, said organic livestock producers don't wall their animals off from ups and downs in the weather. Along with dry bedding and good food, fresh air and some exposure to the elements improves the health of animals. The cold snap puts a halt on harvesting while the crops are still frozen. Leafy greens and other freeze-hardy vegetables will go dormant to survive a deep freeze. Meanwhile, those plants are churning out sugar as a survival response to the cold. Over the next few days, as temperatures soar back to the balmy 30s and 40s, those greens end up in grocery stores and winter farmers' markets this weekend, and they will taste sweet. Look at pictures of how farms were affected by the polar vortex. There's a slideshow at eartheats.org.
Yeah, there's one especially cute picture of a pig who's looking very confused. We'd love to see how your garden or farm is faring. We're collecting your pictures and stories at twitter.com/eartheats. Our headlines from Lou Ann Johnson.
See you next week.
The U.S. has the fewest cattle in the beef supply since the 1960s, and low cattle numbers contribute to higher prices at the grocery store for your steak and hamburgers. But for the first time in nearly 10 years, the beef herd may be poised for growth. As Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach reports, that could eventually mean some relief for consumers at the meat counter.
Wearing a green apron and black tie, Rob Toy fires up the meat saw at Ideal Grocery in Lincoln, Nebraska. Toy is manager of the meat department at Ideal, Today, he's slicing rib roast, selling for $10.98 a pound. Like other cuts of beef, the price has been steadily creeping up.
We can change our prices every week. We make adjustments as we need to. Most of the time, we try to absorb to keep the price to sell.
Retail prices for choice cuts of beef are up 8% over the past year, 20% since 2008, according to the Department of Agriculture. That means the steak you bought at $7 a pound is up to almost $8.50. In many cases, people are switching to chicken or pork. To get at the cause of ballooning beef prices, you have to go to the source.
Well, I'll tell you what, 2013 by far has been the toughest of my career.
Craig Uden is co-owner of Dar Feedlot near Cozad in central Nebraska. Standing in a gravel alley between long concrete feed bunks, Uden's glad to have the recent drought behind him. But it carries a long shadow. Dried up pastures and a spike in corn and hay prices pushed many ranchers to thin their herds.
You know, the herds declined about 1.6 million in the last two or three years. We went from basically 31, 32 million cows a few years ago to 29 million cows, beef cows.
Now it's the smallest beef herd in 50 years. The result for Uden is some of the highest prices he's ever paid to buy calves from nearby ranchers for his 40,000-head feedlot.
We definitely need to keep seeing some moisture come along so we can get a little bit back to whatever we think normal is.
What's normal seems to be that cattle numbers keep dropping. The drought brought a steep decline, but downsizing has been the general trend since the nation's beef herd peaked at 45 million head in 1975. Lee Schultz is a livestock economist at Iowa State University.
We don't really need the size of the herd that we had back in the 70s because we're just able to be that much more efficient in bringing beef to the market.
That is, feedlots are putting on more pounds, more meat per animal. At the same time, many farmers have gotten rid of cattle to raise more crops. When the USDA reports on the beef herd this month, it's expected to show the herd shrank again in 2013. But Kate Brooks, a livestock specialist at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, says there are signs pointing toward growth in 2014.
Improving pasture conditions, corn prices have continued to fall, hay prices have started to become better. We do see some potential within the cow-calf herd, you know, maybe moving out of that liquidation stage and actually starting to see some increases in our cow herd size.
If the beef herd does begin to grow as expected, prices will come back down. But Kate Brooks says it will take at least 2 years. And she says because ranchers will hold back cows to reproduce, beef prices could go even higher before they begin to decline late 2015, early 2016. I'm Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. It's well after New Year's Day, but if you're in your kitchen, I want you to go look in your fridge, or maybe on your wine rack. Did you somehow inherit a bottle of champagne after that party you threw? Or did you maybe forget to bring the bottle you bought? Well, you're not alone, I assure you. But now you're stuck with this bottle for another 11 months, right? Well, no. Brad Dunn wants you to think beyond celebrations when thinking of champagne. He's the beverage director at the Uptown Cafe in Bloomington.
We bought a humongous bottle of champagne.
How big is humongous? From the floor to your hand?
Pretty damn big.
How many glasses?
A Methuselah. It's like 50 or 60 glasses.
Most of us won't be buying champagne in quite that volume. He says a good rule of thumb is think 6 to 7 glasses from one bottle. He came into the Earth Eat Studios to talk about the history of champagne and to give suggestions for broadening the appeal of bubbly from just a celebratory drink to something you'd actually serve with a nice dinner. We can use the word champagne to reference any sort of sparkling white wine.
Oh, are we doing this now?
Yeah, I mean, whatever. But champagne is, you know, for a very specific kind of wine that comes from a very specific part of the world.
The producers of champagne have been very, very careful and very, very smart to designate the word champagne to mean only the sparkling wine of that very, very small region to the east of Paris. Champagne actually exists at the northernmost extreme of viticulture, which means that it didn't grow very good grapes. So actually, it was highly acidic and very thin. They really have trouble ripening the grapes that far north. There was actually a big rivalry with Burgundy to the south. Burgundy was producing this beautiful Pinot Noir, and Champagne was producing this thin, acidic, disgusting, nasty.
Well, they fixed it in the meantime.
They did. Actually, bubbles were initially considered a flaw. What happens is, if you know a little about science, yeast, you use yeast to make bread, and bread rises. Same thing happens in producing wine. Yeast produces alcohol, but also produces CO2. What would happen, think about the annual cycle of harvesting grapes. Grapes are harvested in the late summer, early fall, and then you throw some yeast on there, use natural yeast, and it starts fermenting, and it starts bubbling, and then it stops. Well, why does it stop? Well, one of the reasons, winter approaches. So the fermentation stops, yeast go to sleep, but what happens in the spring, and if you have a good imagination like I do, it's actually really funny. What would happen is in the cellars, can you imagine monks being frightened, woken up as, the warming of spring, yeast woke up, they started fermenting again, and all these bottles were exploding in the cellars of these abbeys. And this actually also happened as the Champagne wine, other people were shipping wine to warmer climates. They would ship them in barrels, and then they would, yeast would wake up going from a colder climate to a warmer climate, and so the wine would become fizzy. So it was initially considered a really horrible flaw until it was documented by an English scientist, physician, I think his name Christopher Merritt. Anyway, so he wrote a paper documenting the purposeful fermentation to create bubbles in wine.
The English?
The English.
Champagne is in France?
Yeah. It's funny. The French were actually very stubborn. It was actually in the mid-1600s that Merritt documented this process, and the French didn't actually adopt it until the early to mid-1800s. So it took them almost 200 years to say, well, I guess this is better. We'll do that. And coincidentally, I said the glass was so fragile, the bottles were exploding in the cellars. In the mid-1600s, the English industrial glassmakers actually came up with the formula for a much stronger version of glass. So it was coincidentally sort of a simultaneous convergence of invention.
Cool. Our wine history lesson today, courtesy of Brad Dunn. Thank you.
Yes. Now, as it happens, bubbles or champagne or any type of sparkling wine really is one of the best food pairs.
I was going to ask that because I've never had a glass of champagne with dinner.
I know.
Ever.
I don't understand how Americans, as fond as we are of soda pop, that it hasn't caught on that, to drink sparkling wine with food.
So can you give me an idea of what would be great with a really nice high-end bottle of champagne? Like make a meal for
popcorn.
Me. What? Popcorn and champagne?
Yes. Your next date night where you're renting movies at home, snuggle up with your honey bunny and grab some bubbles and some popcorn.
I'm just wondering why. Like, have you done this?
It's kind of a thing that they say. And it's fun to eat popcorn with bubbles. But a serious food pair, definitely sushi. Any type of light meat or fish or cream sauce. Anything that you would pair like a nice white wine with, a nice crisp white. I try some bubbles.
We go a little more in-depth about what sorts of grapes are used in champagne and what's a good but affordable bottle of bubbles. Brad Dunn has lots of liquor and beer and wine knowledge. Listen to several other conversations with him at eartheats.org. Coming up, we're revisiting a conversation we started last week about composting.
All, the garden eats soil, it turns, like in nature, there is no waste. I mean, it's all fed back and it is a circle.
Jonas Carpenter and Salem Willard of Bread and Roses Garden and Nursery know this oh so very well. They show us how they're using all sorts of waste to make new soil. And M.L. Orr doesn't compost her dried flowers. She's turning them into something as beautiful as it is useful. production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Taste as you go. That's one of Chef Orr's rules to live by in the kitchen. It'll be easy to do in this recipe. This one goes out to all our Twitter followers who requested juice recipes. It's a green juice, thanks to the kale, parsley, and spinach we're mixing in. But if you want more sweetness, just add some pineapple. Or maybe you need more acid, add some orange juice. Taste and adjust as you go. Just use this recipe as a jumping-off point.
What you need to really remember is to balance your sweet and your kind of more savory vegetables. You don't want to have a whole lot of just sugar in your juices. But you don't want to have something that's real bitter and you don't like. So the whole thing is about balancing those different flavors. And I usually start with my vegetables that are a little coarser or drier. And then I push through the more moisture-full items like the cucumber and celery and things like that afterwards, so I'm sure to extract all the flavor and juices out of the drier vegetables. So we're going to put our kale in. I'm just going to push it down with the cucumber as my press. And I'm going to push another couple different types of kale. I've got some Tuscan kale. I've got some purple kale, as well as the more traditional curly green kale. And you don't want to put too much in your juicer at one time, because then it just gets unmanageable and you'll have to clean it out every time you put a new vegetable in.
So I'm looking at this. On one side we have some juice coming out, some green goo, and on the other side it looks like leftover bits from the kale.
Right, and it's very, very dry and powdery. You can actually use some of those dried out pieces of vegetable in things like soups or stocks, if you'd like, so you don't have to waste that. Next, I'm going to add another flavoring, which is some ginger. And ginger is really great if you got a sore throat or not feeling that great. And some carrot. Carrot's going to give you a bit of sweetness.
So slowly but surely, we're getting juice.
Smell that ginger. When you put that ginger through, let's see if you can smell that.
The predominant smell is the kale at this point.
The kale, yeah. Okay, and we're going to add just a touch of sweetness with some pineapple. And that's going to be what makes it taste good. And then you can throw whatever you want in. I've got some baby spinach, I've got some parsley, all those good green things.
So you're really telling me that this is going to taste good?
Well, I like it. You know, there is the one thing that if it makes you feel good and is healthy, then that's should make it taste better, too. Okay, and then I'm just going to finish by pushing the cucumber through, and that's going to give us our volume. I'm going to finish it with a little bit of what I call my citrus trio, and that's just a little bit of lemon juice, lime juice, and orange juice. And that's going to give it a little bit of acidity, that nice orange flavor. Give it a little taste. Well, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. All right, we'll have a taste.
Cheers, everybody.
Santé.
It was a record week for snowfall and cold temperatures in the Midwest. There's not really much you can do on the farm or in your garden with inches upon inches of snow covering everything.
But the compost melted all the snow right away, so it wasn't an issue. It's so warm, it didn't matter.
We're talking steam coming off the compost heaps at Bread and Rose's Gardens and Nursery. Salem Willard just had to turn the pile to reveal the hot decomposition action inside. He and Jonas Carpenter use all sorts of waste products from the farm and from local businesses to make their own soil.
So what we've got here is a combination of rabbit manure, sawdust, some native soil, and spent grain from upland, and bagels from Bloomington Bagel. So
is that what I'm smelling a little bit?
You're smelling the grain, actually. Yeah. There's
like grain. It's like, you know, it's kind of beer smelling.
It smells a little bit like sweet beer.
Yeah. It's sweet malt. That's the spent grain.
Yeah, we're using a lot of waste products that are coming out of those places and putting them in the compost pile, and they cook. They're hot.
Aerating the piles gets them even hotter, up to 180 degrees hot, because air speeds up decomposition. You need a proper ratio of brown materials, like sawdust, to green materials, like food waste, to get your compost going. One special touch the guys add to this pile? Urine. Yeah, that's right. They're peeing on their compost heaps.
I mean, think about it. You eat lots of nutrient-rich food, hopefully. And not all those nutrients are processed by your body, and a lot of it leaves as urine.
Which is very high in nitrogen, and it's hot, both of which help cook the compost. The end product is used as an additive to their potted plants. Occasionally, they'll get some bonus volunteers popping up out of the compost.
We'll still probably get tomatoes and squash and pumpkins sprouting out of this, possibly, and maybe some lamb's quarter, but for the most part, it also helps to kill off grass seed.
You could get tomatoes sprouting out of this?
Well, yeah, especially since we do use food waste, and so tomato seeds will, you know, do their breakdown process then in the compost and come up in the spring, and that can be a good thing, or it could be just something that turns into biomass or green manure that we just throw back into it.
Although I do have to say the best squash I've ever grown and consistently grown have all come out of compost. The ones I try to grow are okay, and the ones that just come out of the compost on their own are hands down 100 times better.
You know, that squeaks people out, though, the idea of food growing out of compost. Have you ever had people be like...
I mean, the garden eats soil, it turns... You know, like in nature, there is no waste. I mean, it's all fed back and it is a circle.
Nature also produces its own energy, and you can see it literally steaming off these compost heaps. Willard is experimenting with heating the greenhouses with compost. Innovative French gardener Jean Payne took it two steps further by using compost piles to heat water.
People are finding it's possible to, by creating soil and taking advantage of the fact that carbon, when composted, puts off a lot of heat, and you can not only create soil, but you can produce energy at the same time.
You guys, every time I come here, you're doing such cool stuff.
It's always interesting. There's always something going on, for sure. Don't always know how it's going to turn out, but it's so far been pretty good.
Salem Willard and Jonas Carpenter of Bread and Roses Gardens and Nursery. Learn more about their business at breadandrosesgardens.com. It's a chilly day in southern Indiana. Mary Lou Orr is surrounded by bunches and bunches of dried flowers, plants, and herbs. Instead of letting the dried bits from her garden compost back into the soil, she collected them in a large bucket and has found a creative use for them today.
Does anybody see where I put my red scissors?
She's assembling some fire-starting bouquets that will decorate the living room and then eventually be tossed into the fire to keep the flame going.
I just love a fireplace, so they didn't call me Pyro for nothing.
They called you Pyro?
Pyro, no.
So maybe this is a perfect craft for the kid in your family who's maybe a little more interested in fire than you'd like him to be.
Yeah, right. What's fun about this is all those things that are still useful, but they're not prime, and you just kind of hate just to throw them in the compost. Like I've got some extra sage, dried sage in bunches that I didn't use, and the birds had eaten all the seeds out of the sunflower heads, but they look kind of nice in this arrangement. Yeah, and then you've got all these different herbs that have have a nice fragrance when they burn. So that's just a double thing. And then last but not least, you got all those used ribbons that we're going to use to tie them up with at the end. And I've even got there a pretty old wreath, small wreath, that I'm going to use in the top of one of them. So it's kind of a nice way to not waste anything. So now I'll get going in here. The idea is down at the bottom to have stuff that's really going to burn and doesn't look particularly interesting. So I've laid down my sack, which I have cut. I put the printing on the inside so that won't be noticed.
I guess, what are these?
Those are blackberry lilies.
So you got little blackberries. They're these beautiful, like, pale purple flowers.
Yeah.
Oh, the spiky one that always sticks to my pants. What's this one?
Yeah, that's teasel. There's oregano there. And this is nice. It's Russian sage, and it's still got its very fresh odor, and it's very pretty with the blue flowers. And then I kind of like to use the London Times, the Financial Times, because it's pink. And so I've saved some old ones of those because they'll be a little bit different in the thing. Now, see, I'm just folding it up like your local florist would do. Folding it around.
So everything in here is flammable, even this twine that you're using?
Oh, yeah. That I wouldn't use wire for that reason.
That is the sound of mighty hands tying some twine. So you're really stamping it down.
Yeah, because I'm going to get it inside a wine sack.
Oh, you got to do some more stamping then.
Yeah.
Are you going to be able to fit that in there? I don't know about that. I'm impressed.
There. Whoops, I don't want that.
ML spent most of the day out on the porch assembling these bouquets. Just gorgeous. And burning one of these did make the room smell even better than it already did, believe it or not. Check out a photo of ML and her finished bouquets on our website, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Jonas Carpenter, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and Mary Lou Orr, Salem Willard, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage, and Hatha Yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years. Building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900. Or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Leaving you this week by reiterating a point made by Jonas Carpenter. In nature, there is no waste. Words to live by. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.